to me, coaching is about working with the experience that the individual already has. It's about helping them make the most of that experience. It's about helping them derive learning from the things that they've have happened to them, and make some sensible choices about what they can do next. So from an HR point of view, that's where I think that the emphasis ought to lie. It's not really about adding things to the individual. It's more about helping them make best use of what they've already experienced.
Welcome to the HR L&D podcast with your host, Nick Day. Tune in to discover what it takes to truly develop within human resources as we delve deep into growth, engagement, and leadership strategies that will help you unlock the hidden potential within your business. By listening to this podcast, we hope to empower you and your workforce towards achieving significant HR organizational success.
Today, I'm really excited to introduce Matt Summers to the HR L&D podcast. Now, Matt is a leading voice on training and coaching in the UK. He's an author of two publications, Coaching at Work, published in 2006, and Coaching in a Week in 2016. Now, more importantly for the HR L&D listeners out there, he holds an MSc in HR development, and he's also a fellow of the CIPD, and he runs his own business called Coaching Skills Training Limited, which is a specialist training consultancy focused on the idea of the manager as coach. Now, what's really exciting about this episode is Matt gets right into the granular level of detail in relation to what coaching means, how you can utilize coaching to really engage your employees. And more importantly, we discover just how Matt views coaching as being an absolute pinnacle part of what makes a great leader. So whether you work in HR, whether you work in leadership and development, this is a podcast I think you're all really going to enjoy. He's very eloquent, he's very articulate, and I look forward to sharing his knowledge with you now. Enjoy. So hello and welcome to the HR L&D podcast. I am, of course, joined today by Matt Summers, who runs Coaching Skills Training Limited, a specialist training consultancy focused on the idea of the manager as a coach. Welcome, Matt.
Hello, Nick. Thanks for having me on.
Really good to have you on board. We're going to dive straight in.
Five quick questions. Understanding where we are to know where we are going.
Obviously, you are a very experienced coach, as I've already mentioned in my introduction. But what I'd love to do is just, if you can, just give the listeners we've got out there a little bit of an insight into your background, Matt, from your perspective that's led you, your journey that's led you to where you are today on the HR&D podcast hot seat.
Yes, happy to. So if we go back in time, about 25 years ago, gosh, that's a long, long time. I was working for one of the big UK banks, and that particular bank was quite pioneering at the time and had the idea that it would be great to train up the managers in coaching skills. And I was working in the training department, the L&D function at that point, and put my hand up in the air to say, yeah, I'd love to get involved in that program. So I got exposed to coaching in an organizational setting back then. Nick, this would have been about 1994, I guess. And I would have to say it was a revelation. I remember sitting there listening to this stuff and having coaching properly explained to me. And I guess my first thought was, I wish I'd been managed like this. If I'd been managed in a coaching style in my career at that point, life would have been a lot happier, I think, for both me and my managers. And I'd have probably done a lot better, you know. And that kind of started the interest in coaching as a set of concepts in an organizational setting. So then later on, by now I'm running my own training and development consultancy. I decided quite soon into that venture that I ought to specialize in coaching, because back then this was still a fairly new kind of concept in business. So it was a good niche to occupy.
Fantastic. Now, of course, for the listeners out there, I should mention you do hold an MSc in Human Resources Development and you're a fellow of the CIPD. Now, the reason I mention that is just to give it some context, really, because when we hear the word coach and we try to define it, it can mean many things to many people. We can get a huge variety of responses. So from the context of an HR, well, qualified HR professional as you are, Matt, how would you define the word coach?
The word coach or the word coaching? I'm sorry to be semantic, but,
No, be semantic. How about we define them both? For sure, that'd be great.
Well, I guess there is, and we might get into this down the pipe, a difference between an internal coach and an external coach in terms of what they do and how they do it. And then there's, of course, what we mean by coaching. and how that might be different to some of the other things that, that we do and we talk about in the same sorts of conversations, mentoring, training, and so on. So in my view, there are some subtle but important differences with coaching and some of those other things. We can certainly get into that. I can talk about that some more if it's appropriate to do so at this point.
Sure, yeah.
So I think one of the really useful ways to think about this or say to people is look at which way the wisdom flows. So to me, if I'm training somebody one-to-one perhaps or doing some mentoring, then I'm probably the wiser person and the wisdom is going to flow from me and my experience, and I'm going to try and do my best to get that into the head of the other person in a way that resonates with them and that they can understand. Coaching, in my experience, is very different. To me, coaching is about working with the experience that the individual already has. It's about helping them make the most of that experience. It's about helping them derive learning from the things that they've have happened to them and make some sensible choices about what they can do next. So from an HR point of view, that's where I think that the emphasis ought to lie. It's not really about adding things to the individual. It's more about helping them make best use of what they've already experienced. So this takes us to the notion of perhaps complementing other learning and development that we might be doing through formal courses, perhaps, with some coaching before and after that. That can be hugely powerful. You know, coaching before somebody attends some training can really help them become focused on what it is that they want to get from that training event. And if they're focused on what they want to get from it in advance of it, then they're more likely to spot those sort of opportunities or those learning points when they arise. And then similarly, if we do some coaching when people get back, well, that's hugely, hugely helpful in making sure that that training event has been a rich experience. And we really increase, in my view, the chances then of that training kind of being sustainable down the track, which is, I know, something that HR people are always wrestling with.
Sure, that makes sense. So can any HR leader, L&D professional, predominantly, obviously, of course, are responsible for this kind of area, but can any HR manager be a coach?
Well, I'm reminded of the line, I think it was from the movie Jurassic Park, where something along the lines of just because you can doesn't mean that you should. But let me sort of unpack that a little bit. I mean, I think that, yes, I think that the skills and attributes of coaching are available to anyone who's mindful to do it. Some are going to be better than others. It's been my experience that there are life's natural coaches who were probably doing coaching long before it had that label and can certainly pick up a few hints and tips and away they go. Other people, it's maybe not their natural style, or they've become very, very entrenched in what we tend to think of as a kind of command and control type approach. For them, it can be more difficult. But in my experience, yeah, I think anyone who's willing enough to try can probably make a decent fist of it. I tend to go further personally, Nick, in the argument, to be quite honest. It's my view that anyone who is a manager of people is a coach, whether they like it or not. It seems to me that almost from the point that you get that requirement to get results through others, well, then I think you already are a coach, and it makes a huge amount of sense to me to try and do that as well as we can, because I think I don't think it's ever neutral. You know, I think if we're not developing people, then we're probably holding them back.
So with that in mind, then, would you say that when you're training, or if someone wants to go on a leadership training course, leadership being quite a word that needs unpacking in itself in terms of what that means, but in order to be a good leader, often you need to be a good coach and they're one and the same, or if you're a poor coach, it becomes therefore very difficult to be a good leader. How would you unpick the two things from leadership and coaching?
Yeah, well, I mean, I guess the situation, the context is hugely important in that. A glib example might be that in the case of an emergency situation, or perhaps in the armed forces or something like that, where people are trying to perform in extreme circumstances, then arguably a coaching approach with its emphasis on, you know, trying to understand the experience of the other person and generate their views could be wholly inappropriate. And in those more extreme situations, you would need some stronger, more assertive style of leadership, I suppose, something that's going to be done. But the average workplace most of the time it isn't like that, and behaving as if everything is an emergency is kind of unhelpful. So I think for the most part, yeah, in terms of running an organization, running a team within a business, then to me, yeah, coaching and leadership, they go hand in hand. One sort of feeds the other, I think.
So in your mind, Matt, with your experience, what qualities should HR professionals be looking for in internal coaches?
Yeah, it's an interesting one, because I guess qualities covers a multitude as well. We might think of skills or qualities, attributes or qualities. Funnily enough, when I'm doing some coach training, we often get people to kind of list them down or flip chart them out at the front. And without exception, always the first one is the capacity for effective listening. I mean, that is just the number one quality. And I think that can be developed to a degree. But again, some people are just naturally very, very good at that. Others less so. The ones that are naturally good at it, I think, have a huge advantage. They're kind of halfway down the track in being an effective coach, because that's such an important quality to have and a thing to be able to do. And most people, I think, listening to this will recognize the difference between hearing and listening, and the type of listening that's quite superficial, where we're maybe just trying to find a chink in the argument so we can intervene quickly with our next contribution, you know, and that kind of rehearsal that goes on in our mind. But active listening, or a more empathetic type of listening in coaching, requires us to kind of quieten our own mind and really, really tune into the other person. So I think people who have that quality are at an advantage and make a huge difference to the coaching approach. And then after that, I'd say the next two most important probably is empathy. This idea of walking a mile in another person's shoes, the ability to put yourself in the, I'll use the word coachee, it's not a great word, but you know what I mean, the person being coached, to be able to put yourself in their situation, even if you haven't had quite the experience that they're describing. And then the third one would be credibility. But important for me to emphasize in that, I think a really vital part of understanding the point of credibility is to be credible as a coach. It doesn't mean you have to have expertise. It doesn't mean you have to be the one with all the answers. It doesn't mean that you have to have done all the jobs or routines or tasks of the people that you coach. But yeah, you have to be credible enough to get people to open up and talk to you, or the coaching isn't going to work, or it'll just be a tick box exercise with the coachee just saying what you want to hear. So I think listening, empathy, credibility are the three most important ones.
So if I presented to you, Matt, an individual, you know, experienced leader, for example, who is demonstrating good skills and active listening, good empathy, has credibility through that experience, where would you take them on the next stage of their coaching journey? What would be the sort of crucial areas of training for a manager or leader that sort of possesses some of those qualities already?
I have fairly emphatic answers to that, but it comes with a health warning as well. So the next logical step after what you described, Nick, is we need to help the individual understand the questioning approach. So I've banged on about listening, and a lot of trainers of coaches do, but we've got to have something for us to listen to. So to get a good conversation going requires us as coach to have good questioning skills. But again, I think this is often undercooked in a lot of coach training development or training managers as coaches. They get a short session and they're handed some example questions, usually organized around the grow sequence, you know, the goal, reality, options and will or way forward. Very popular coaching idea. But we need to understand the power of those questions. We need to understand that asking coaching questions is not really designed to elicit information for the coach. Coaching is not diagnosing in a way that a doctor, you know, would ask questions. What coaching is designed to do instead, I think, is to be very provocative and cause the person thinking about the question to think to a higher degree of quality than would be typical, a higher degree of quality than they probably get any other chance to do in a very, very busy working day. Because, as I said at the top, it's about having the individual kind of go into their own experience and draw some learning points from that. So the questions need to provoke that sort of thinking. So It's about developing the capacity to ask questions and developing the capacity to run a coaching conversation with a beginning, a middle, and an end. But it's recognizing what those questions are designed to achieve. And that isn't finding out information so that the coach can say, yes, I get where you're going with this. I can diagnose the problem. Here's what you need to do. And we sort of lapse back into advising mode.
No, I see that a lot. And actually, it's also a good example of how leadership shouldn't always be binary about someone sort of saying, do this, do that, and instructing. Actually, it's about employees finding their own answers to solution, you know, to their own problems, but working them through with a coach, I guess, to give them the confidence to come up with some of those answers and solutions and then implementing them.
Just going to sort of add to that, and again, it's a bit of an old cliche, but it's this idea of, you know, if we're a parent and our child presents in front of us with their shoelaces undone, you know, well, in that moment, we can bend down and tie it up for them, and that's quick and easy to do. Or we can invest a little bit of time in helping them learn how to tie their shoes for themselves. That's going to take longer, but then there it is done. Hopefully you won't ever have to do that again. So again, part of the coaching approach with the asking the questions and the listening and all of that, you know, the output from those things is to have somebody who's perhaps better able then to do without us, you know, to work independently of us, freeing up more management time and more time for more strategic leadership work, et cetera, et cetera.
Sure. That makes perfect sense. It was a great example. So to bring it back into the context of an L&D professional potentially listening to this, we know that often, you know, they're going to be the individuals required to encourage employees of a business to take up more coaching, to take up more training, to upskill departments, whatever it might be. We also know that against, you know, working against them, whether you work in HR or any other department, is the matter of time. And often time is one of the biggest obstructions to individuals wanting to take up training because they don't have the time to do it or they don't feel that they need it. How, from your experience, would you recommend an HR or an L&D department went about building a coaching culture or encouraging more people to take up coaching?
Great question. I mean, I have to say, I think there's inevitably going to be some training as part of that. But that doesn't have to be lengthy classroom sessions or qualification-based approaches necessarily. There's a huge amount these days that can be acquired online, of course, although I personally take the view that it's very difficult to replicate online the kind of the skills practice that you would need to do inevitably to kind of get good at coaching. But then I think there are other things that we need to do around that to make sure that any time that's invested in upfront training is then maximized, you know, so that we get that kind of value. So, for example, I think one of the things that HR can do quite readily is break the notion that coaching is remedial. I think in organizations, this is a bit of an easy rabbit hole to chase down, that somebody gets coaching when somehow something is going wrong, you know, so there's some underperformance or there's been an incident that needs repairing, in inverted commas. I think that's a bit of a mistake because, one, I think that kind of undervalues all sorts of other things that coaching can be very useful for, not just remedial stuff. And the other thing is it tends to have people feeling a little bit exposed then if they're getting coached. Their reaction might be, well, why am I getting coached? What is it that I've done wrong? So if that's how it's been sort of set up or positioned, then we can understand why some people might be reluctant to get involved. So this is my roundabout way of saying one of the great things that HR can do, I think, is encourage the already high performers to very visibly take up coaching. Because in my experience, that sends a huge message out there that this is a really, really good thing. You know, if people see some of the people that are widely known as acknowledged as good people in the business or in the organization, yet they too are taking up the coaching that's being offered, whether that's internal or external, that sends a hugely powerful message. And I suppose this kind of resonates with the sporting world. Often we talk about that in coaching conversations where even the very best performer wouldn't dream of trying to operate free from a coach, but it's hardly as if their skills and abilities are in decline and it, there's a remedial aspect needed there. Some of the very, very top performers still, you know, regular ongoing coaching. And the coaching, of course, is not about at that stage giving these people new skills or new abilities, but it's more pure coaching. It's absolutely about helping them make the best of what they've already got.
Sure. No, great answer. And I guess, you know, the saying that comes to mind for me when you're talking through that is the old adage that prevention is better than cure, that if you're able to, you know, be proactive to encourage a philosophy or a culture of coaching before there's a problem, hopefully the problems never arise, number one, because you've got the coaching in place to prevent it, would be then you're not treating it as a reactionary process to bring coaching, as you say, because of underperformance or something different. So I can totally understand that.
Well, I agree. Yeah. I mean, I think, again, that too often we coach because something went wrong. Now, coaching is a great way of identifying what went wrong, trying to understand where the warning signals might have been that something was about to go wrong, and then perhaps making some changes in systems or processes or whatever's needed to try and make sure the same thing doesn't happen again down the track. But yeah, had we had a coaching conversation in advance of the crisis, well, then maybe it would never have happened in the first place. So, coaching in advance of something happening is just as, if not more important than coaching after something has happened.
Mm. I've got a coach, albeit not in a recruitment context, but I'm going to take it slightly left field here, but I've got a coach for running, and I have a running coach that helps me compete performance. And something I always struggled with was things like injuries, and I wasn't quite getting to the level I felt I could get to. And one of the first things they implemented, and it won't be a surprise to those out there that enjoy sports of any kind of level, really, but that is I didn't do enough stretching, warm-ups, mobility, flexibility work, because I felt like if I wasn't really under some kind of stress and I wasn't hammering the treadmill or the road, that I wasn't really making progress. But actually, in increasing the mobility work, my injury rate has gone, I'm not injured now, it's gone a lot better. And actually, it has knock-on effects on performance as well. But because you're not always breaking your sweat doing it, you don't always necessarily see the benefits immediately, and that's when you trust your coach that they know what they're doing and they're giving you something, because that's where their expertise lies. It's going to help you in the longer term. And it's only really now I'm starting to see that myself, albeit it's not a professional example. It's a good example of prevention rather than cure sort of later on.
Well, I think you see, you know, I think you see the organizational equivalent of not stretching and attending to those sorts of things in organizational life. I mean, how often do we go finish off one project and leap straight into the next one without taking any time really for the download, you know, that time to reflect on what happened, what went well, what went less well, given our time again, what we would do differently. Certainly in my organization experience, there's rarely the time devoted to being able to do that. So we launch straight into the next project without learning from that prior experience, and lo and behold, go on to make the same mistakes again. To me, that seems to resonate very clearly with the idea you describe about never stretching properly, warm-ups, warm downs, and so on that a runner would do.
Sure. No, but perfect example. Well, listen, we're going to find out a little bit more about some of the books that you've written in part two, and we're going to touch on some subjects, including employee engagement, which is a really hot topic right now. So before we get there, though, Matt, I'd just like to find out a little bit more about you.
Time to find out more about you.
Number one, who are the sort of the two people who have been the most influential to you in your career to date?
Oh, wow. Okay. So I've been really, really fortunate in my career to learn from the knee of the two masters. So many people tuning into this, if they're in the UK, will know of the late Sir John Whitmore, who sadly died last year, seen widely as a pioneer of coaching in the UK. So the story I was telling earlier on about my initial exposure to coaching and my first coach training, I was lucky enough that was delivered by Sir John back then. And he and I kept in touch in the years that followed. He was hugely helpful to me when I set up my business and wanted to specialize in coaching, and lent his support to the books that I wrote. And I found him to be the absolute epitome of good coaching. You know, it's unsettling sometimes when you meet your heroes in this life and they perhaps turn out to be less sincere than you'd hoped, but my goodness me, anything but the case with John. He was the living embodiment of coaching, and I was very, very fortunate, I think, to spend some time with him and to be coached by him amazing guy. But he himself would acknowledge being highly influenced by Tim Galway, who people like me would consider to be the very godfather of all coaching. And he's the guy behind the Inner Game series of books. There was the Inner Game of Tennis in 1974, which many people say kind of incepted the world of sports coaching and sports psychology as we know it now. One of the things that Sir John and his peer group at the time leaned into when they were getting business coaching going in the UK was Tim Galway and his ideas. So again, I've met and worked with Tim as recently as this summer. And it's just an extraordinary experience to be in the company of these kinds of people that just have such an insight into the human mind, into human behavior, and who can articulate that understanding, I think, in some very easy to understand concepts that the likes of me can understand and then take forward. That, I think, is the great gift. So those two guys, who anybody with even a passing interest in coaching will know, have been instrumental in the approach that I take. And like I say, very, very fortunate to have had that experience.
Brilliant. And I'll make sure there are some links to those individuals in the episode notes as well, if people want to find out more about either Sir John Whitmore or Galway. So I'll make sure that's available. So are there any resources out there, Matt, that have really helped you on your journey?
Well, I would have to point, I suppose, to the literature of both those guys in my previous answers. So Sir John's seminal, really, work on coaching for performance, which I think is now in its fifth or sixth edition, has been translated in just about every language on the planet. I think any aspiring coach, internal, external, ought to get that as the key work. And then go into any of Galway's Inner Game series. So I'd recommend either the Inner Game of Tennis. I mean, people say to me, Matt, what's the best business book you've ever written? And I'll often say the Inner Game of Tennis, which kind of gets some strange looks. And I'll say, but you know, tennis is kind of irrelevant. That just happens to be the context that Tim Galway learned his stuff in. But honestly, if you read that book, there are so many life lessons and therefore so many business lessons from that. So those two, I mean, I've got very well thumbed copies of both of those books on my shelf, and I probably read each of them about once a year. And it'd be one of those, Nick, where every time I read them again, I get some new insight, and it frustrates the hell out of me because I think, well, why didn't I get this last time? You know, I could have been using the idea. So for me, it was books. These days, all sorts of online resources, any of the coaching bodies, the ICF internationally, the Association for Coaching here in the UK, all of their stuff, I think, absolutely fantastic. The webinars and the recordings of those webinars. I guess the great challenge really is sort of knowing what to pick and choose, because there's so much out there. It can be a bit overwhelming, but there's some real quality material online.
Excellent. Fantastic. Well, again, I'll make sure that both those books are linked in the episode notes for those that are interested in picking up either Coaching for Performance or Inner Game of Tennis. I quite like the idea of the Inner Game of Tennis, because sometimes I read a lot of business books and you can get a little bit, what's the word I'm looking for? Overwhelmed, I guess, with the amount of business literature, as you said, out there. And being a fan of sports, actually taking a sporting approach that I can adopt, I think would probably suit me. I'd take a look at that myself. It sounds quite interesting.
Well, yeah, I mean, I highly recommended. And Tim Galway wrote a book, I think it was about 2000, this one was released, called The Inner Game of Work. Because what had happened with the Inner Game of Tennis is a lot of the guys that he was doing tennis coaching for at country clubs around California, where he lived, were, you know, C-level executives in US corporations at the time, and coming back to Tim and saying, well, look, you've helped me with my backhand. Can you please come in and help me with my sales team or whatever it was? And of course, the answer is, well, yeah, because the principles are exactly the same, because the principles are to do with helping people learn from their own experience. So whether that laboratory to discover that is the tennis court or the cubicle or the office or the meeting room or the training room, it doesn't matter. The principles are exactly the same. They easily translate.
Excellent. So we'll have two more questions. Let's have a bit of fun before we jump into part two. If you could be given any superpower, what would it be and why?
I think invisibility, I guess that probably comes up quite a lot.
Well, people always take two approaches. I think people either take the fun approach and shoot ice from their hands or something similar, or they think really deep about it and want to, you know, have more empathy in the world, whatever it might be. So let's go with invisibility. Tell me why invisibility. We'll work out which angle you've taken.
Well, because, you know, I would like to be invisibly present on some coaching conversations. Particularly those kind of students, if that's the right word of mine down the years, who assure me that they take on board my every word and implement my every suggestion. I'd love to see that in operation, you know, but you can't do that visibly because people tend to get a bit sort of awkward and upset and they change their behavior, you know. So it would be lovely to see people acting free from the observer, you know. It would be a researcher's dream, wouldn't it, to be present, seeing what you've taught playing out without influence how it's being out, because people are modifying their behavior they can see in the corner.
Oh, I totally get it. Being a fly on the wall, as they say, would be something I think all of us would like in some way or another. So no, I totally understand it. Great answer. So last question before we dive back in. If you could invite three people to a dinner party, they can be dead or alive, who would they be and why?
Goodness me. Well, I'd have Sir John and Tim again, but I've already spoken a lot about them. So let's try and branch out from that. I suppose in my work, I think a lot about performance and high performance and what it is to be a master of a craft. So I'm going to say that the snooker player Ronnie O'Sullivan, to me, is incredible. I mean, it's perhaps not the widely known sport across the globe that it is here in the UK, but I don't think that I've ever seen a sports person who is more a master of their craft than Ronnie is in snooker. So I'd love to try and have a conversation with him and understand how he's reached those heights. They're really absolutely...
He's got a personality as well, isn't he? Let's be honest. It'd be a lot of fun at a dinner party.
Well, yeah, you know, there's that as well. And I must admit, I'm kind of less interested in any tournaments once he's out. There doesn't seem to be quite the sparkle amongst some of the others with the greatest respect, but... You know, that man at his peak, I think, is a very vivid example of what it is to truly be in flow, which you often, again, talk about in coaching, you know, trying to get people into some kind of flow state where they can do their best work. Ronnie at his peak is a vivid example of that. Similarly, I'm into my music. I am a ham-fisted bass guitar player. So Mark King, who was and is the bass player with Level 42, UK funk band. Once again, just virtuoso stuff, amazing ability to be master of his instrument. And again, it would be a fascinating conversation to try and understand the nature-nurture thing. I mean, how much of that is a gift to be able to be a virtuoso player of a musical instrument? How much of that was teaching and 10,000 or more hours of practice that supposedly we're all supposed to, you know, to try and acquire before we can get mastery over anything. I'd love to try and understand that. And was it three people at a dinner table?
It was, yeah.
It was. So there's two. Let me think of a third one. Wow. You. How about that?
I'll take that. I'd love to be there. I'd love to see Ronnie O'Sullivan, and I'd be interested in Mark King as well, a musician myself. So I'd happily attend. So.
Brilliant. Well, I'd be so starstruck that I wouldn't be able to think of a sensible question to ask. You could tip in for me, given your interviewing experience.
Oh, you're very kind. You're very kind. I'll definitely be there. Actually, before I jump back in, you raised a little point there about the 10,000 hours of practice. Now, I've read Bounce, which is what that, if I'm correct, is what that's based on, the author that talked about becoming a world championship level table tennis player. And he sort of wrote a book called Bounce, which was all about having 10,000 hours of meaningful practice to become expert. I think the key thing in there was that meaningful practice piece. But what's your view as a professional coach? Because I've heard lots of different views on this. It seems to be quite a subjective book, and there are people out there that have tried to debunk the myth and you know, called it a myth and it doesn't quite work, and others that swear by it. But as a professional coach with your experience, particularly someone who, you know, as you say, worked closely with the likes of Sir John Whitmore and Tim Galloway, who is obviously Tim in particular, who's written about sport in itself, what's your take on that 10,000 hours of practice? And from your perspective, is it something you believe in?
Yeah, so I'm familiar with Bounce, which I think was Matthew Syed, wasn't it? The former Olympic level, I think, table tennis player. I know Malcolm Gladwell's written about the 10,000 hours as well. I'm not sure in which of his books and which came first, his or Matthew Syed's piece. I'm nervous about putting numbers to things that, you know, 10,000, I guess, you know, sounds really good. It's a bit like the 10,000 steps or whatever that we're all supposed to take on our Fitbit. I mean, it's just a nice, convenient round number. But there's something in that, you know, there's something about needing to have tried something or performed a requirement a number of times to have generated learning experiences from it. So even though I wouldn't put a number to it, I do think there's merit in that idea. What I've certainly found to be the case through coaching is coaching can help practice become more purposeful. So I think one of the things that happens when we practice anything, whether that's a motor skill like a sport or a musical instrument, or whether it's a more conceptual thing like, you know, understanding a sales conversation, I think when we try and practice, it can be easy to just lapse into old habits, to practice the things that we're already good at because we feel very comfortable in that arena, to waste a lot of time because we're not really focusing on the areas of practice that are areas that we need to change. So it's easy without support for practice to become quite meaningless, I suppose, you know, and it to be a bit of a waste of time and energy. So practice that happens as a result of a coaching conversation, which is really drilled down into what's going well, what's going less well, what do you need to practice, how will you know when things are improving, how will you evaluate your success, what will you do when you've mastered that bit, is it appropriate to concentrate on building strengths, is it appropriate in your practice to address weaknesses for now, those kind of conversations, I think, can really put a much sharper focus on practice and therefore accelerate one's improvement. That might mean you only need 8,000 hours as opposed to 10, I guess, you know, to bring it back to that. So I think there is absolutely no substitute for practice, but it's got to be purposeful practice.
Yeah, no, I love that. And actually, without knowing it, because I haven't shown you these questions that I've prepared, I took this this podcast recording and the answer you've given leads us perfectly into part two. So we'll jump to a quick advert break and I'm going to continue with the next question.
Have you ever asked yourself, how can any recruiter understand my HR recruitment challenges? Please don't give up on your hiring challenges just yet. Here at JGA HR Recruitment, we appreciate the difficulties associated with attracting, recruiting and retaining top human resources talent. We also understand just how costly a poor hire can be. JGA HR Recruitment would like to partner with you to help you overcome your hiring challenges. Contact us today on 01727 800 377 or visit jgarecruitment.com to find out more.
Shaping the future of human resources together. Final questions.
The question I was referring to is, you've talked about the purposeful practice. How do you go about leaving a footprint for the coaching approach work you do after you finish working with a client? So you've given the coaching and you mentioned being that fly on the wall, but making sure that it's all the invisible in your example, making sure the coaching does take place. But what kind of, you know, how do you go about leaving that kind of footprint?
Yeah. All right. So great question. And I think the start of the answer is to recognize that what coaching does, and this might help distinguish coaching from training as well, because training is more, I think, behavioral. You know, it's about getting people to adopt a new way of doing something. Coaching is about changing people's thinking. It's been my experience that before you can change what people do, you have to change how they think. You have to change the mindset. You have to change their ability to find their focus amongst the white noise. Otherwise, it tails off. Anyone in HR and L&D has seen this countless times, that, you know, the dust is thrown up in a training session. Everything's great for a few weeks, and then that old forgetting curve kicks in, and the effect diminishes because probably no permanent change took place. So to give you an example of that, I sometimes do some work with public speakers, trainers, or people who give keynote talks or might have to pitch and present to try and win new work in their business. And one of the things that they'll often ask for some help with is what we might think of as verbal tics. So filler words, you know, basically sort of people become aware of those things peppering their conversation, or ers and ums, or nervous noises that they make. So traditionally, what we might do is point out to people that that's unhelpful and suggest that they try really hard not to do that. Well, unfortunately, trying really hard is a notoriously poor way of changing anything. It's like saying to somebody who's suffering with insomnia, well, you must try harder to sleep. It's kind of counterproductive. You know, trying just creates tension, and that's the very last thing that you need. So what I would do with a presenter who's experienced or who wants to change the amount of these filler words and phrases that they're using is I would just say to them, well, count how many times you do it. So in this next practice presentation, don't worry about trying to remove the ahas, the ahums, the you knows. Just count how often you do it. And they'll say, well, that would be really awful, won't it, if I do it a lot? And I said, well, let's not judge it as good, bad, or otherwise at the moment. Just count how often it happens. And this is where the coaching magic kicks in, because if they're aware enough to be able to count how often it happens, well, then they're aware enough to stop it happening. I hope that makes sense. You know, this idea of raising people's awareness, bring it into consciousness, is often all we need to do to secure something, to use that example. So aware enough to count is aware enough to stop, and there it goes. You know, it sort of disappears. And change at that level then, because that's the person has come to that conclusion for themselves. Another coaching principle alongside awareness, which I've just spoken about, is responsibility. You know, it has to be change that the individual is in control of. So because they've arrived at that that conscious awareness of what they're doing for themselves, it's not been imposed on them from the outside. They're not trying to adopt a behavior to meet some external standard. Then in my experience, it tends to be much more permanent. So those are really the two main aspects of a coaching approach, is bring something to somebody's awareness. Before we can change anything, we need to be aware of how it is now, and then ensure that they are and they see themselves as responsible for owning that change. And I think you've got two ingredients then to try and make sure that sort of sustains despite the pull of bad habits and so on. I mean, it might need more than one coaching conversation, of course, but it's going to be a lot more effective than just saying, well, stop this bad habit, because that really doesn't work.
Sure. So, I mean, for HR and L&D professionals listening to this right now, we've got sort of the word or the sentence, I say, employee engagement. It's kind of a hot topic right now. Everyone's talking about employee engagement, brand engagement, as well as also a real hot topic at the moment, where particularly with businesses, they're trying to improve their retention, they're trying to reduce their attrition. We see it all the time as HR specialist recruiters. You know, people are looking about and asking us questions about salaries, how they can attract more people to their brand, how can they can keep them engaged to improve those retention levels. So being such a hot topic within HR circles, and with this in mind, how would you recommend businesses approach gaining more loyalty, trust, and commitment from its people through your kind of coaching approaches?
Yeah. Well, I wouldn't pretend to be an expert on the technicalities of employee engagement across the piece, as you describe it. But I suppose the window that I look into is that old cliche of people join organizations and then leave managers. I think that an individual's relationship with their line manager, the person that they consider to be their boss, is a huge component of their sense of engagement, and probably one that might, if it were an inappropriate or not a particularly productive relationship, I fear it would probably trump some of those others that are more in the realm of, you know, pay and reward and so on. And coaching absolutely speaks to cementing effective relationships between a line manager and their team member. Because if you take a moment to think about it, if you're my team member, Nick, and I take a coaching approach with you, that's probably going to see me asking a lot of questions and listening very, very carefully to your answers. That's very visible demonstration that I value and honor your input, your experience, that I see you as a a professional person with a point of view that I'd ought to avail myself of your manager. So that's a powerful building block of trust, which, as you've said, is in itself a powerful building block then of engagement. Also, I'm having a coaching conversation with you, I'm going to get through that conversation an awful lot of insight into what makes you tick at the individual level. So I'm going to get insight about what you find engaging. I'm going to get insight around what you find to be motivating. Those things are likely to be different to the next team member and the next team member and the team as a whole. They'll be unique to you. So rather than throwing a blanket over the team when it comes to engagement and thinking, well, all of these ideas are universally motivating, we'll institute a team night out every third Thursday because everybody finds that motivating. Well, everybody doesn't find that motivating, actually. For some individuals, that can be really difficult. They might have commitments outside of work that make engaging with something like that really quite problematic for them, you know. So through the best of intentions, we've ended up creating a problem where perhaps none existed previously. But if I take a coaching approach, I will get that insight into you uniquely. And of course, there's not always something I can do about that. You know, we can't necessarily have individualized engagement programs, but it's going to take some of the guesswork out of it. And it's going to let me know to what extent the organizational level and organizational wide type of programs might appeal to you as an individual and where they might not, and where perhaps I need to do something a little bit more bespoke for you if I can. So to answer the question, I think that by far the biggest component of engagement is the relationships that people have with others at work. Key amongst those relationships is between team member and their boss. And the ability of the boss to engage with the team in what I might observe as a coaching style would be hugely impactful on that for the positive.
It's a great answer. I've been referencing in my mind as you were talking about things that we do internally, and it's true in recruitment. So a mistake that I've made in the past, and you know, sometimes I have to remind myself of it, is that a great recruitment consultant who may be very successful doesn't always A, make a great manager, and B, doesn't always want to be a manager either. And sometimes, you know, I've been quick to, certainly earlier in my career, I was quick to make the assumption that people always want to make the next step up into management. Well, actually, if you're very successful as a consultant, you don't always want that extra responsibility. You're achieving the goals you set out for yourself, which can be very individual. Whereas there'll be others who perhaps may not be as successful as a consultant who have proven to be extraordinarily good managers within a recruitment division. So it's a great example that you've mentioned there that I was just referencing my mind to say that without asking the questions of the teams that I've managed, you never really know what motivates them. It's very easy to say, well, everyone's motivated by money or by title. And actually, it's rarely either of those things. It's usually something that's a lot more, you know, insular and important to them at a more granular level than something quite so sort of wide ranging as title or salary. But I learned that the hard way by making mistakes, for sure.
Yeah, well, likewise. And I mean, I will have this conversation with managers and leaders quite a lot these days, and we'll talk about what it is that people find motivating. And then sometimes a manager will say to me, well, you know, be it pay or conditions or title or status or whatever the motivator that they latch onto is, they'll say, well, it motivates me. And I have to say, yeah, but you're not a particularly representative sample of the wider working populace. You know, you're just new. So the fact that you find an aspect of working life motivating does not give any clue as to what your team members do, and whether or not you think that they should is kind of by the by. It doesn't work like that. But to come back to your point on recruiters and managers, I mean, I see this a lot in the sales environment. So how often is it the case that the person that gets the job as the sales manager is the currently best performing salesperson who are powering through their numbers each quarter and so on? But countless times I think that's an error, because to me, the skills and qualities that you need to be a very effective salesperson often don't read across to being an effective sales manager. In fact, sometimes they're kind of poles apart. And therefore, the successful salesperson, when it comes to making the transition from getting results from themselves to getting results through others can become highly, highly frustrating because it just doesn't work anymore. And then they end up kind of intervening and getting back on the tool, so to speak, and doing some direct selling themselves, which gives them even less time to work with the team, which means the results of the others decline even more. And it's a really unhappy sort of vicious circle. But I remember once seeing an example in, I think it was magazine advertising. And magazine advertising is and was hard. That's a hard sales gig. But in this particular magazine that I had some involvement with, the sales manager in the guys that were selling advertising space had never been a salesperson himself. He'd never worked on the phones and never sold the advertising space, which was just anathema to most people. But he was just such an effective coach. He just had these people being the best that they could be. And that, I think, is hugely significant. As a coach, it's not about how good I might be as a performer in that same realm. It's about how good can I make you? And those are the best coaches. You know, they're free of ego. They're not really worried about their own results. What they're concerned with is how do I have the people that I'm coaching fulfill their own potential? And it just seems to be a difficult thing for a lot of people to grasp, but it's so, so important. In order to be an effective coach, you do not necessarily have to have been the best or even a great performer in the same field. You just need to be really good at coaching other people.
You do touch upon some of these, or actually most of those elements in your book, don't you? Your first book, which is Coaching at Work, Powering Your Team with Awareness, Responsibility and Trust. And I will put a link to the book. It's on Amazon in the episode notes for those interested in finding out more about it. But I know in that book itself, you discuss how businesses, you know, try to balance the needs to do more with less. And you can do that by creating environments in which people can grow, develop and achieve their aspirations. Obviously, you've touched on a lot of those areas there. Is there anything more that the businesses can do to achieve more with less?
Yeah, I think it's about, it comes down to learning. So Tim Galway, who I referenced earlier behind the inner game of tennis, has a concept which he calls the PLE triangle. And in that triangle, those letters stand for performance, learning and enjoyment, arranged on a triangle, which suggests that we need those three things in balance. So the idea, without getting into too much detail, is that if we can create environments, Nick, in which people can perform, i.e. do something well and derive satisfaction from that. So if they can perform and they can learn and they can enjoy their work experience in equal measure, well, then we've set up the conditions really for high performance. But all too often in organizational life, we concentrate only on the P for performance and neglect learning and enjoyment. So oftentimes, I think one of the ways in which we can increase people's ability to do more with less is have them learning from experience. So again, because it's in my mind, if I sort of fall back into a sales example, a salesperson might be only making a successful sales conversion from one call out of every 10. But what are they doing with those other 9? You know, all too often they're just regarded as being failures in inverted commas, but they're not, are they? They're 9 other opportunities to learn about what works and what doesn't, in which case all 10 of those calls are useful in terms of the bigger picture, even though it might only have been one of them that's resulted in a client sale. So I think if we're looking for some quick wins in that regard, well, then it's beefing up the attention that we pay to learning from experience across a day's, week's, month's task. You know, what are we learning? What should we do more of? What should we do less of? What should we stop doing entirely because it's a redundant process now? I think in my experience, we don't often put those things under the same lens or give it the same emphasis that we do to matters of business performance and our KPIs and ratios and all of those harder measures.
Sure. No, that makes sense. And actually, I mean, you talk about it in more detail in your second book, which is titled Coaching in a Week. And I know that in there you've broken it that coaching principle, those coaching principles into 7 chapters, and each chapter tackles a different aspect of coaching. You've broken it down by days as well. I wonder if just before we finish, where people can find out more about yourself, Matt, whether you can just talk to the listeners a little bit about the aims of the book and your key coaching principles within it that, as you say, are broken down in sort of 7 key principles that can really help organizations.
Yeah. So the idea of that book, I mean, it's part of a series. So the publishers Hodder and Stoughton have an inner week series. So there was project management in a week, time management in a week, and so on, successful in appraisal in a week, all sorts of business titles. And I came to that realizing that there wasn't a title at the time on coaching, so decided to see if I could contribute to that. And they were kind enough to let me get involved. And the idea is, you know, 7 parts, 7 days of a week, you learn a little bit more on each day. So a lot of that book is devoted to a questioning model based on the GROW sequence, although I use slightly different letters. But since you mentioned principles, I think, again, it's worth me emphasizing that principles are the things that make a difference with coaching, that without an understanding of coaching principles, then the GROW sequence, or my version of that, which I call the ARROW model, or there are dozens and dozens of these things out there. But if they're not founded on principles, they won't work. And those principles are awareness, the idea of using a questioning approach to get people to think more clearly and therefore become more aware of what's happening to them. The second principle is responsibility, that it's the individual who's going to make change in the end. So they have to be responsible for the actions that they take. It has to be from a place of choice on their part. And then thirdly, trust. Because if we think about the two things that we spoke about earlier on in the conversation around skills that a coach would use, going to be a lot of questions, going to be a lot of listening to the response. But if there isn't a trusting relationship between the two individuals, that won't work. It's just going to be a superficial thing with the person being coached just telling us what it is that they think they want to hear. So in that book, Coaching in a Week, I think, you know, across the course of 2 or 3 days or 2 or 3 chapters, I really get into the detail around that, because it's so, so important to understand that before we let loose on the questions. Because without that, the questions can be quite damaging, really. You know, if we're not able to know what to do with an answer, then just asking a question in and of itself can be quite risky.
Sure. I think you've very eloquently put the coaching process into perspective for the listeners out there throughout this podcast, so Matt. So thank you ever so much for that. I think, you know, coaching, as I said right at the start and first question, can mean so many different things and can be defined in so many different ways. But I think from a commercial perspective, you've given a really articulate version of how coaching can really benefit organizations. It can benefit in so many ways. It can benefit leaders, individuals that the leaders are coaching. It can improve employee engagement. It can build trust. It can help with the, you know, critical elements of the emotional side of you know, corporate psychology, whether it's building empathy or anything else. And I think you've given a fantastic account of both the work you do, and more importantly as well, from the context of the listeners we've got here, how, you know, good coaching can really benefit HR and L&D departments for all businesses and beyond. So thank you ever so much. It's been a real pleasure having you on board. If people wanted to know more about yourself, Matt, or wanted to connect with yourself to either, you know, engage your services or to find out more about your coaching philosophies, where would you recommend they went?
Useful links, keeping the HR L&D community connected.
Well, I have a website at www.mattsommers.com, MATTSOMERS. But these days I prefer LinkedIn, because I think that's a much more two-way kind of interaction than people just viewing a website. So I'm on LinkedIn at @MattSommers, spelled the same way, obviously. I'd love to connect with people on there, and would be happy, more than happy, to engage with anyone who's come by me by way of this podcast. That'd be great.
Excellent. Fantastic. It's obviously how we got talking as well, Matt, to start this podcast on it. So it's a great way to connect. I'm a big fan of LinkedIn as well. And I'll make sure that the links to both your LinkedIn profile and your mattsommers.com address is in the episode notes. So if people want to fast track links to Matt's profile on LinkedIn or to his website, just click onto the episode notes and you should be able to click straight through, either from your mobile device or your desktop device or whatever tool it is you're using to access the podcast. I'll also put some links on there as well to the two books I've mentioned. So the first, just to reiterate, was Coaching at Work, Powering Your Team with Awareness, Responsibility and Trust. And the second book is Coaching in a Week, both available on Amazon. So you can either do a search on Matt Sommers or do a search for either of those and you'll find it. But I'll also put the links to both those books in the episode notes as well. Of course, just to finish up, if you are an HR or L&D professional listening to this podcast and you've got an HR, HRIS or L&D related vacancy and you need some specialist HR recruitment support, please do get in touch with me. I would love to help show you what a great HR recruitment experience can feel like. And you can reach out to me directly at nick@jgarecruitment.com or give me a call on 01727 800 377. It just leaves me to say thanks, Matt, ever so much for joining me today. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Pleasure, Nick. Thank you for having me on. I appreciate it.
It's been all mine. I hope the listeners have very much enjoyed it. And I look forward to bringing everyone the next episode of the HRND podcast real soon.
Thank you so much for tuning into the HR L&D podcast with your host, Nick Day of JGA HR Recruitment. If you need help with a current HR or L&D vacancy, then please get in touch with Nick and his team. All contact details can be found in the episode notes. In the meantime, to make sure you never miss an episode, please subscribe to the show through any of your favorite podcast channels. Till next time.